Welcome to the High Premises Files podcast with me, your presenter, Charlotte Howden. I'm an HG campaigner and the co-producer and presenter of the world's first documentary about hyperemesis. Sick, the Battle Against HG is available now on Prime Video in the UK and the US, with other countries following soon. The High Premises Files podcast acts as a voice for all women who are currently suffering with or who have survived hyperemesis gravidarum.
This is the final episode of Series 3 of the High Premises Files podcast. And to finish off this series, I'm joined today by Rowan. Rowan was one of the women who featured in Sick, the Battle Against HG documentary, and she is now 25 and mother to daughter Olia. She lives in Lancashire with her husband Alex, and before her hyperemesis pregnancy, she was a police control room officer. This is Rowan's hyperemesis story. So Rowan, you mentioned to me that when you first got your positive pregnancy test, and the nausea started. You felt quite smug and you said that you felt properly pregnant. So I just wanted to pick up on that because I think that's really common for a lot of pregnant women. And I know that's how I felt. Like, I think I would have worried if I didn't have the sickness. So, you know, is it quite fair to say that you're quite happy to be feeling sick and nauseous right at the start?
Yeah, I was definitely happy to be feeling sick, which sounds quite ludicrous in hindsight after what I went through, but it's like when you first get that blue line, it's the only confirmation that you're actually pregnant, and until you get any symptoms you can't really associate it as being real. So when I did get that sort of initial wave of nausea, I started to sort of hear the term morning sickness in my own mind, and I attributed what I was experiencing to mean that I was definitely pregnant and this journey was real, and it made it a lot more exciting at that point.
And it's the irony of it, isn't it? Because I felt exactly the same, and you just feel, I think that's quite something that's ingrained in society, that sickness is a really positive thing until it isn't.
Yeah, and I think you find that people around you make comments along the lines of it being a sign that the pregnancy is progressing well, that it's a good thing, it means your hormones are rising, and it starts in them early days as a condition that it's actually a good thing for you to feel unwell, which is quite conflicting at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously at this time, you know, you're very early pregnant and the sickness and nausea has started. And so whilst you're thinking, oh, this is good and it's normal and it's usual, you know, like most of us, you're working at the time, going into work, trying not to be sick and feeling sick. You were feeling that bad though, weren't you? Even at this point, this was 5 weeks pregnant, that you went into work one morning and you literally had to sit down, your line manager down, and tell him at 5 weeks pregnant that you were pregnant because the sickness was just getting so bad. What was that experience like from your point of view, having to tell someone so early? And then I'm assuming it's a man, actually. I've been saying he, so you'll have to correct me if it isn't, but what did he or she say to you?
My shift would start just before 7 o'clock in the morning, and as soon as I'd wake up, even in them quite early hours, the sickness would start and I was struggling to get myself to work on time. So upon being late, I obviously had to give some sort of explanation, and it's quite hard to hide sort of quite severe vomiting. You can see it, I think, in your eyes and your face and in your demeanour, and being unable to eat and drink. So I just came to the conclusion that I could either sort of try and hide something that was possibly quite obvious, or I could just have a conversation with my manager, and it was a male. So I did actually feel quite vulnerable in a sense to have to go into a room and tell my manager that I didn't have, you know, any sort of personal friendship with. It was purely, you know, a professional working relationship, that I was actually pregnant, I hadn't told some very close people in my life purely because I'd only known for around a week myself. So I felt like I had to sort of share something really sort of intimate, and his response was quite hurtful to me in that moment. And upon reflection, I'm sure he didn't mean to cause offence, but when I explained that I was pregnant and that I wasn't feeling well, he paused before asking if I was actually happy about the pregnancy. I can only assume that he said that because I may have looked sad or unwell, but it just seemed as though the first sort of person that I'd told outside of my very close family had questioned that this baby that we so desperately wanted was almost some sort of inconvenience to me. And, that started a ripple effect of, is this what people are going to think? So it was quite a hard experience to do that. And I was quite upset after that conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, something you just said really hit home with me, in that was your first experience of telling someone outside of your very, very close family, and to get such a negative, misunderstood response about how women should or shouldn't feel when they're pregnant. I'm not surprised, actually, if that kind of did plant a little bit of a seed for things that, you didn't know at the time were going to come, but when they did come, this feeling of not really wanting to talk about what was actually happening to you because of the response that you were going to get. And in fairness to you, given what he said to you, it's not surprising that you would feel like that.
Yeah, definitely. I think another big factor is just sort of how vulnerable you feel when you're so unwell. You almost need guiding by people around you, and you're quite heavily influenced because you just feel so exhausted and unhealthy, I suppose. So when I was sort of telling someone that was usually, an influence as my line manager, I just automatically had the opinion, I suppose, that everyone I worked with would think the same. And I think it almost worried me that I looked unhappy and people were guessing that I was pregnant, and that was starting something. And it was a bit of a almost like a circle of worry I started myself with, that it was obvious to people, but their first thought was that the baby was almost like an accident or a mistake. And that was the last thing I wanted people to think of when I was experiencing something so awful. To continue on with this pregnancy, you don't want people to almost make a judgment of you. You want them to, congratulate you and spur you on. So
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I do think it was highly inappropriate what he said to you. I mean, if you'd had because some people have a professional relationship, obviously, with their managers, but also a personal one. I know I have with both male and female bosses, where I can imagine maybe someone saying to me, "Oh, but you do seem so sad. What's going on here? Are you okay?" As opposed to, "Oh, are you sure that you actually want to be pregnant?" I mean, there's a line, isn't there, really? And I think that he crossed that, in my personal opinion, without obviously knowing him. But, and I think that really reflects a lot in our society, where people feel like when you're pregnant, they have this right to judge you, talk about your pregnancy. Whereas, a week before, when he didn't know you were pregnant, he probably ne would never have said anything like that to you.
I experienced that throughout the pregnancy on various different occasions with both professional and personal conversations, where people would just pass comments that they wouldn't in any other context. And especially with suffering from hyperemesis, I found that it almost gave people this right in their own mind to make a comment on your physical appearance or otherwise. And I just wondered, if I'd have had any other condition that wasn't attributed to pregnancy, would people have given me their thoughts? I highly doubt it. And that pretty much started from that conversation with my manager. And it was something that I think, even until you're in the early days of being a parent, I think people continue to make those comments. The difference.
Absolutely. At that point, you probably wouldn't have known what it was going to be like trying to keep going into work, and how it was almost going to become impossible. So So that was at 5 weeks. How many more weeks were you able to continue going into work?
I left immediately after that meeting, and that was the last time I'd been in work for a full shift. So it would have been the day before, but I could only at that point sort of dip in and out of work, which I purely did for the financial benefits of avoiding, a long period of absence leading to no pay. If I could manage to do a couple of hours here and there, then it would, stop me having no income whatsoever. So with the support of my doctor, I would have a fitness to work note for a couple of hours. But even at that point, when I would be in work, I faced criticism from sort of, my peers or my employer just for being there. But the situation with HG is that there's a whole picture to consider, and that you do need to think about the fact that you've got a small baby on the way, and if you haven't, planned for potentially, 6+ months of no income, then you can't just as easily as it sounds just go off work and not get paid, because we just assume, like everyone else, that we would have an easy pregnancy. There was no history in the family or with myself of complications, so there was nothing to prepare us for the fact that we may have needed to save up for, months and months of my wage. So I did just have to find a way around doing a few hours here and there.
So at the 6 week point, you were already really very ill, and the nausea and vomiting was just becoming persistent. Tell me about the conversation you had with your mum, and, maybe your kind of general feeling, which I think we all share, about medication in pregnancy.
So I distinctly remember actually sitting on my mum's sofa and just talking through with her that things felt quite unmanageable, and we have a close relationship, so she was there every day with me through this and was well aware of how much I was struggling. And we were sort of just going through the usual self-help remedies with nausea and vomiting, trying to see if there was anything we hadn't thought of. Mm. And at this point, antiemetics came up in conversation. It's not something I've even considered, but she just made me aware of the fact that you could take medication for nausea and vomiting. But we jointly sort of assumed at that point that, oh no, you can't take that whilst you're pregnant, it's probably not safe. We'd never heard of any other woman taking this kind of medication.
Yeah,
we'd only ever heard stories of, oh, my sickness was really bad, but that was just the way it was. And we just sort of brushed it off ourselves, because even with a quick Google, we couldn't find anything particularly clear. I mean, I now, I know where the resources are, but until you know where to look for the information with a quick search, we just didn't find anything that was encouraging to say that I would have access to that. And we just assumed that, you're pregnant, you can't take anything.
Absolutely. And I think that's another barrier that we face, and that the knowledge around this, the information around this, we all, like I said, when I asked you the question, I think we all just automatically assume and know, actually, in fact, we probably say we would know that you can't take medication in pregnancy. Like when you have a headache, you can't go and take paracetamol or ibuprofen. That's just something you know that you have to put up with for however many months that you might get headaches. So I don't think that's surprising. And I wonder if at that point, how you were in your head, were you trying to just rationalize things away and just be like, oh, I just must have really bad morning sickness, and listening to other people saying, it is going to pass, we've just got to get to the 12-week mark, and it will go away, we've just got to get through this first trimester?
It was normal. It was what was to be expected, in fact. So that's sort of how normal it was. It was something that near enough every other woman in my position would go through. And of course, the fact that we didn't know about medication meant that all of those women were able to manage it at home. And it almost just crushed that inquiry in my mind about taking anything, because it was just a case of everyone else can get on with it, so why can't you?
At 6 weeks pregnant, Rowan made an appointment to see her GP. Her parents and her husband were supportive of her going to ask for help and to get the medication that her mother had heard of that could be taken for pregnancy sickness. Rowan says that having that support enabled her to work through her feeling of being a failure and that asking for help was okay. When you made the next step and you went to the GP, you didn't actually get to see your GP, did you? And you were told to go and speak to the community midwife. Tell me what she said to you.
Yeah, so I was just automatically advised that the midwife would be best suited to speak to me. And that was purely on the basis of being pregnant. There was no other rationalisation for that direction. The midwife was quite sympathetic and kind towards me, but she just said, this is normal. Everybody, you know, near enough experiences sickness and it won't last for a very long time and you will be okay. There was no sort of clinical examinations or investigations. You know, she didn't assess me in any way. It was literally just a conversation of support that I would be fine, which didn't help me at that time because, of course, you know, at some point you will be fine again, but you're seeing them because you're not fine in that moment.
Yeah. And then I think after that, not long after that, you did something that I know personally exactly what I did and other women do this. You went and had a private early scan, didn't you? So you could see the baby. And one of the reasons why I did this, actually, kind of following on from the type of things that people will say to you, was that everyone was just convinced I must be having twins because of my sickness was so bad. And so I thought, well, I would like to know that. So I went and had an early scan like you did. How did you feel going into that scan? Did that give you a bit of a boost seeing your baby for the first time, even though it was obviously very early?
Yeah, I was extremely nervous at that point because although people around me were telling me the sickness was normal, obviously I knew minute by minute, hour by hour that I was, you know, literally suffering through the worst physical feelings that I'd ever been through in my life. And I did have concerns that the baby wasn't going to be okay because I just couldn't understand how I could be so poorly, you know, and the baby would be fine. So it was definitely a nerve-wracking experience, but as soon as we did at that point get to see a heartbeat, it was just an ecstatic feeling.
Yeah.
It was the first association that this awful illness that I was enduring was for a person, you know. Yeah. It was for our baby, and we'd even, I think, struggled to associate this as our child, you know, our son or daughter. It just seemed such sad circumstances until that point. And I used to just look at the scan picture. It was, you know, just a tiny little bean at that point at 6 weeks. And you know, I just hold on to that photo and know that this is who I was doing it for. And it was definitely, you know, such a emotional, almost, you know, like a push to keep going and to keep every morning when the sickness would start, just knowing why I was doing it. And it was just priceless for me. And I would absolutely do the same thing again. I really needed to go to that appointment.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think because if you think about it, really, throughout the 9 month period, if everything is okay, you have a 12-week scan and a 20-week scan, and that's the only two times you get to see your baby. So when you are going through what we go through with hyperemesis, it does give you that, just that little push just to go, okay, it is real. I know it's real because I'm so sick, but now I can actually physically see that it's real. And then not long after that, so you'd had a bit of a pickup from seeing your baby for the first time, and then you were actually then prescribed some antiemetics. But sadly, they, in your own words, they weren't even touching the sides, were they?
No. So the first line of medication I was given, I was so hopeful for. I think it was almost this point of, you know, I've finally been given some medication, like there is medication out there. I had quite high expectations, I think, naively at that point. I thought it was going to make everything better and I'll take these and it'll go away. And then almost when it didn't do anything, I felt like, oh, you know, this was the absolute last resort to go and see the doctor and ask this medication that I'm probably not meant to take anyway. And it's not worked. Like, you know, what am I supposed to do now? And there wasn't any conversation with the doctor that there was other things available or those other avenues. So it almost just pushed you back into that hopeless, like, I'm just rubbish at being pregnant and I can't, you know, even respond to the medication. Like, what is wrong with me?
Yeah. At nearly 10 weeks pregnant and still without any medication that was helping, Rowan was bedbound. Her parents came around to see her and discussed going back to the GP. But this time, Rowan's mother would go with her to advocate for her and give Rowan the strength to also advocate for herself. Something about this innocence reminds me of just how vulnerable we are when we have hyperemesis. And Rowan spoke to me about how her inner child was hopeful that if it was her mother who was speaking for her, then maybe she would be able to fix it. So you make your way back to the GP again, but this time you're armed with your mother, which I just love. And the, what I just said in the last intro, and when I read your story again, it really resonated with me. And it is that kind of feeling of, you know, your mum is always the one that fixes everything, sorts everything out. And even though you are now a woman yourself, having her support and being with you, you naturally must have felt like, okay, I've tried, I can't do it. My mum's going to step in now and she's going to sort all of this out and we're going to come away and everything's going to be fine. But sadly, that wasn't the case, was it?
Yeah, that's absolutely how I felt. It's almost like your mum's your secret weapon. And if they're not listening to you, you know, I'll take my mum and my mum will tell them what's what. And, you know, my mum isn't, you know, shy to say her opinion. And she was just fed up of seeing me suffering day to day. You know, every day she was trying to help me with, could you try this? Could you try that? And also, she didn't want me to have to take medication if it wasn't the right thing to do either. So, you know, it was almost like the end of her tether as well. You know, like she was fed up of watching this day in and day out. So off we went together. And I was just feeling so weak that day that I really needed, you know, almost someone to drag me there and sit me in the chair. So we went along and I just couldn't believe that I almost let my guard down and I told the doctor how I just could not cope. Exaggerating, I just was really honest and said that I cannot live like this. It is not an option. And to my utter, you know, complete shock, the response was that it could be worse for me. And the GP actually, you know, said that some people had cancer and were undergoing chemotherapy, which in turn meant they always felt sick. And, you know, unlike me, their sickness wouldn't ease. So, you know, it wasn't that bad. I'd literally, you know, poured my heart out to this person, telling them that I simply could not go on. They told me that it wasn't that bad and, you know, that I was essentially lucky to not have cancer. It was just completely irrelevant for one. And it was just, I just didn't even know what to say back to that. I mean, it was like, everything I'd said meant nothing. And, you know, don't complain, you know, be glad to be pregnant and, you know, you're not suffering with something else. But of course I have compassion for them people, which I said in that moment, but it was also very difficult to be experiencing sickness at a level where you just could not eat or drink anymore. So
yeah, absolutely. And actually that's the clip that you sent in to me for the sick film. And what is, again, I don't know if irony is the right word, but him using that analogy with cancer. And then when you watch the sick film, we have the leading researcher in hyperemesis saying from her own studies that women with hyperemesis, it looks like have this certain hormone protein, GDF15, in their blood. And it's like the difference between a cancer patient of, as to what level of sickness they would experience with this same protein hormone, which is when they get something called cancer cachexia, ours is so much higher than that, that actually we experience sickness more than a cancer patient would do. And of course, your doctor didn't know that, but the fact that he chose that analogy, and now we can say, hang on a second, whilst the outcomes for us, of course, are different to perhaps a cancer patient, what we suffer in that moment is definitely inarguably worse. And his final piece of advice really to you and your mother was, well, if you really think she's that bad, take her to hospital, which is obviously then when your mother's, I'm assuming, I'm picturing, stood up and said, well, I will do. And she did, didn't she? She took you to hospital. And at that point, someone listened and you were admitted and you were given fluids and anti-sickness medication. So I'm assuming at that point, after that intervention from your mother, you started to think, okay, maybe things are looking up. Maybe people are taking me more seriously. But when you were in hospital, you started to experience some of those negative comments and those judgmental comments. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah, so you're exactly right with what you said there. It was absolutely a case of my mum standing up and being like, well, I will take her then. Like, goodbye. And off we went, you know. And I went on to sort of like an assessment unit. And I just, at this point, didn't really want to talk. I was so drained and exhausted and just sort of felt like I didn't even care what was happening at this point. I would just sit there and hope that somebody would sort me out. And this is when somebody first sort of passed a comment to me. It started off with the fact that they noticed, oh, you know, you're quite young to have a baby. And I was thinking, you know, what am I? Like, you know, at the time I was 23. So, you know, a young woman, but not too young, you know, obviously to have a baby. Of course, it wouldn't have mattered how old I was. I could have been any age. And if I was suffering from a pregnancy related condition, I would expect to be treated with the same level of respect and care as, you know, any woman of any age. But this comment was sort of passed to say, we're holding my notes. I think it was the sort of part of the hospital experience where you get the wristband, you know, and they're checking your details. So if you can picture me sort of sat there and them giving me, you know, these sort of, you know, the band and everything. Mm. And I think at that point, it's when they notice that there would name, and it was like, oh, you're married. Oh, you must be recently married then. Essentially getting at the fact that, oh, you've just got married because you've become pregnant. That was how I perceived it.
Yeah,
they didn't say that, but you can just sometimes tell by someone's look and voice. And I was just so shocked because I was, you know, thinking, one, why does any of this matter? Like, so what if that did happen? But two, it was just like a judgment in some sense that, you know, I was just like almost like a young little girl that didn't know, you know, what pregnancy was like and sickness is a part of pregnancy and like, oh, you're a bit young and whatever. Yeah. And questioning me on, oh, when exactly were you married then after this? And this bit sticks in my mind because, you know, I couldn't remember when we got married in that moment, which just shows how sort of dazed I was. Like, obviously, I know our wedding date, but I couldn't have told them for the life of me.
No.
I don't know, because my brain just wasn't in, you know, the place to start discussing my life history. All I was thinking about is I need to stop being sick. But I just felt like they were letting it be known that it seemed as though I was just a young, you know, first time mum, you know, that didn't really know what was going on.
Which is just utter rubbish, because there was 10 years between you and I when we had our first child and our only child. And I was just as confused. I didn't know what was going on. I too believed everyone that it was just morning sickness and that it would pass. I too was dismissed. And it's got nothing to do with your age as to how well you can cope with hyperemesis at all. In fact, you know, there are other factors that can help. Like if you have a very good support system, which you definitely did, you had a very loving family, your mum was by your side, lots of different factors, but age most certainly isn't one of them. And like you said, Rowan, it's completely irrelevant. This isn't a condition that only affects 25-year-olds. And so if you were 23, they were like, oh, well, it can't be that. You know, it's so irrelevant. And I can just imagine poor you lying there thinking, is this really what you want to ask me about? Do you not want to ask how much food I've been able to eat in the last week, or how much fluid I've maybe been able to keep down, or how my mental health is? Because I think those questions are a lot more relevant to them being able to help you than whether you're married or not.
I just was at that point thinking all of those things, like, why are you asking me? You know, I'd finally got a professional, you know, to see me, and all I wanted to talk about is what had happened to me, to understand what I was going through. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to know whether this was normal, whether I would be okay, you know, whether the baby would be okay. But it almost felt like they were more concentrating on, let it be known, you know, that we've taken note that she's a little bit young, and we're going to let her know that. Like, in my view, even if they thought that from my, you know, appearance, I may have looked young, why pass that comment?
Yeah.
You obviously make a comment when you want someone to be aware of your thoughts. And
absolutely,
for whatever reason, they felt that I should know about that. And I just didn't understand why I'd waited all this time, you know, to basically get seen in the hospital. And this was the conversation that I was being asked at that point. I don't really know what that was all about.
So you were discharged from hospital. You left with some anti-sickness medication, which I believe was ondansetron. You're getting closer to that 12-week mark, that magical, wonderful milestone when all, you know, where all the sickness is just suddenly going to stop, because that's what we're all told. You've got your medication, and your next kind of goal, very similar to your early scan, you know, you had such a wonderful experience seeing your baby at 6 weeks old. So your next goal is to get to your 12-week scan and really to enjoy that moment and not like let the hyperemesis take that experience over. And you know, you said to me that you were trying to manage that day by not eating in the morning so then you wouldn't be sick. And yet you were sick, weren't you, on the way to the scan? Were you sick when you were at the scan as well?
I remember being sick in the car on the way there to start with, because I'd bought a new sort of little dress that I'd wanted to wear, you know, to make myself feel a little better. And I just remember thinking, like, don't be sick on the dress, you know, like, you will look nice today. And almost carrying the sick bag to the bin in the hospital car park and just feeling that almost wave of embarrassment again, like, oh, this isn't how it's meant to be, you know, like, we should be hand in hand, like, you know, so happy on the way to see our son or daughter, but, you know, it wasn't like that. And then we're in the waiting room, and again I'm like, you know, sort of whispering to my husband, like, I need to find the toilet, like. And you almost, every time you enter a room, you're like sussing out where the toilet is, you know.
Yeah.
So you've got your escape and you're not trapped. And I almost felt like everyone in the room knew what was going on, and they were looking at that woman, you know, that kept getting up and going out. So that was the experience before. And it was like when I was getting the scan done, I was literally holding my breath so
yes,
that it just couldn't come out. I was like, you will not come out of my mouth and ruin this experience. Like, we are going to enjoy this scan. Like, you know, I don't actually know whether I was sick during the scan or not, because I ended up having so many throughout the pregnancy, some of which I was sick during and some I wasn't. It just became, in the end, what another one of those scans, you know, in my memory 18 months later. But every time I went, it was, you know, with that awful paper sick bowl in hand, you know, and everyone around you can see you almost carrying the bowl of shame, which is, you know, you may as well have a sign on your head saying, I may be sick at any moment.
Yeah. And those moments as well, trying to get through a day, and it, you know, to other people who haven't ever seen or experienced hyperemesis, you know, trying to get through an hour is really very tough, and you wanted to do that for this day, and you, in fact, you'd booked a meal after the scan with your family so you could all kind of celebrate together, which you said was quite a blur to you. But those moments of trying to, you know, be the old Rowan just for a couple of hours, they must have been very exhausting for you. And I wonder if after the fact, you know, 2-3 days later, you ever thought to yourself, you know, I just can't do that anymore. I can't try and be not sick for a couple of hours because it just takes so much away from me.
Pay a price when you've got HG if you do anything other than almost give in to it. So if you do have to or want to, for some reason, just ignore it and push it away, you know, to the best of your ability, then it's like a couple of hours would be a couple of days in bed. I'm sure you know what I mean, Charlotte, with that. You almost have to sacrifice, you know, the coming days. So we went for this meal and I obviously had to fight away the smells of being in a restaurant, you know, the sort of fighting the vomiting, because you don't want to have to go into the toilets when you're away from your home environment. And to do that, by the time you get home, you're in bed for the rest of the afternoon, which is what happened. And the only reason I felt I could do this is because of my family that were so supportive. You know, they wouldn't have said a word, and they didn't, about me not ordering anything to eat. You know, they would be ready to say something to the waiter to brush them away if they were to pass comment. You know, they would all order meals that wouldn't, you know, be too much of a trigger for me. They would make it possible. So everyone had to sort of change the way they would usually be just to allow us to have, you know, absolute maximum an hour out of the house. And then I'd end up just going home and being like, oh, you know, I'm absolutely worn out, like it's taken everything out of me to go to the hospital. And yeah, you get home and then you're just needing to like sleep it off. It's like an event, and it's really hard to get your head around, because you'd usually, you know, in my job, I'd be out the house for 12 hours a day working, and you come home and make tea and have your evening. And then to just be out for a couple of hours, you'd then need a couple of days in bed. And I think the only motivator to do that was for things like scans, because they were such a push for me.
By the 20-week scan, Rowan knew that she was having a daughter, and finally felt that she wasn't just ill, but pregnant. She was becoming used to the "you look pale" and "oh, you're so thin" comments, despite having managed to gain some weight back, and things seemed to be looking up. She had now accepted her HG diagnosis and was able to research the condition, and was thinking that perhaps she wouldn't be one of the unlucky women who would have HG for the whole pregnancy. Sadly, this wasn't to be the case. So you get to the 20-week mark. You finally now have a diagnosis of hyperemesis gravidarum. And I think in your own mind, you were then able to go, okay, I can put the thoughts of this is normal, it's just me being weak, because I actually now have this diagnosis. But this period, it seems to me like you were about to just start going on this roller coaster of being admitted to hospital, given fluids, giving anti-sickness medication, discharged, at home for a couple of days, repeat. Am I right? Was it just literally like you would be in hospital, out of hospital, in hospital, and there was nothing really keeping you out of hospital?
That's what happened. So you'd get admitted and have some fluids and some IV antiemetics, which would, for me, always help me to feel better. And once it would get in my system, I'd then eat a little. And then because I'd eaten, they wouldn't need to keep the fluids up, you know, because you were doing it on your own.
Yeah.
And then that would happen for a short period of time, and you'd be sent away with a slightly tweaked dose of the medication, you know, or a new medication. And then as soon as you were off that IV fluid and antiemetics, my body would just, you know, start vomiting again, and then the oral antiemetics wouldn't stay down, and the vicious cycle would repeat.
Yeah.
And then it would lead to the hospital again, and the little circle was just going round and round because the so it was almost like the tick list of trying the slightly different doses or different combinations. Like none of them, you know, had any effect for me. So when I was being discharged and they'd say, this is what we're going to do, you know, I would be saying back, that isn't going to work for me. But obviously I can't see into the future, so I'd just be advised that I needed to give it a go. And it was almost like you were just working your way down, ticking the boxes of what you needed to do, and it was just so laborious, and I never really felt like I was making progress because I just knew that by the next week I would have to spend time away from home, back in the hospital, working my way through the next thing on the list.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like they weren't perhaps being very efficient in keeping you out of hospital, but also on the other side of the coin, and this is something I really respect your honesty on, and I think I felt the same as you, was that you yourself have said, you know, said to me that there were times when you knew you probably should have gone back into hospital, but the trauma of all those experiences of being in and out and in and out, you are able to kind of say to yourself, no, it will be okay, I don't need to go back in. And you almost prevent yourself, don't you, because you're like, I know what's going to happen, I'm just going to go back in, and they will make me feel better for, you know, maybe 12 hours, maybe 24 hours, but then I'm just going to be ill again. So it's kind of like, what is the point?
I'm a balancing act, really, of looking after both my mental and my physical well-being, because, you know, to someone that doesn't, you know, understand what it's like to go through HG, I'd just explain it to them as, you know, you can be in your own bed with your loved ones looking after you, and, you know, your own bathroom if you do need to, you know, be sick or have a shower, or if you're not coping, you've got all that privacy and support around you, versus going into, you know, a noisy, busy ward environment with potentially a shared bathroom. You know, that they do quite a lot of sort of they have a lot of invasive requests when you're on a ward. Like they constantly want to measure your urine output, you know, they want to see the bowls of vomit, they have all these things that they do, which of course is looking after you, but you know, it's so sort of degrading in a sense when you're doing that on such a regular basis, and all the reward is you know, a couple of bags of fluid that may help you for, as you say, 12 to 24 hours. And you've got to try and decide, at what point do I really need that for my body and for my baby, versus what point do I just need to be, you know, with my husband, you know, what point do I need a hug, what point do I need someone to tell me it's okay? Because at the end of the day, when you're in hospital on a weekly basis, your partner's life goes on, they have to go to work, you know.
Then we come to a part of your story where we have a little bit of a breakthrough, and you meet a consultant in the hospital, and it's at this point that things start to change for you, don't they? Someone takes you seriously, they are very interested in helping you, and the conversation actually turns towards steroids, which, for anyone listening who doesn't know, that is really the last line. That's the last place you can go with hyperemesis to help. And like you said, they try everything else before. And I do understand, because obviously steroids has not side effects necessarily for the baby, but it's a bit like on Dansetron, the side effects for the mother, you know, some of them aren't particularly nice. So of course, if you can find a medication that works, that's a bit lower down the tree, as it were, that doesn't have some of the horrible side effects for the mother, then of course you have to try those. But steroids really is the last kind of line of defense there. And I just wondered what your thoughts were when that was suggested to you, that actually it sounds like we need to try you on steroids because you've just lost too much weight, and then you might gain a little bit back, but then it just comes off again. You know, you're in and out of hospital. We need to take this seriously now, and we think that steroids is the way to go.
It was a real breakthrough for me because I'd been aware of steroids for some time, having spent many days, you know, in bed. You start Googling, and the later you get into the pregnancy, the more knowledge that you have. So I was glad when this word was brought up in conversation. You know, we'd basically gone through this really long list, and as you say, we got to the end of it, and it was just almost like a recognition that what I was going through was serious, and this consultant in question was, you know, justifying the need for the steroids, just on the basis that being malnourished was really dangerous for both me and the baby later on in pregnancy. You know, we didn't want to risk any sort of early labour coming on. We didn't want me to have sort of any, you know, issues with my other organs, which would potentially be life-threatening to the baby. So we got to a point where if I continued to not eat and drink, my body was just going to start shutting down, and we didn't want to end up in an emergency situation, which this consultant absolutely recognized was a very real risk to me. And it just seemed as almost in an instant, I went from being this woman that was complaining about a sickness for months on end to being recognized as somebody that was actually quite unwell and was at risk of being in a lot worse state if we didn't do something, if we didn't act. So the consultant didn't hesitate at all in the discussions around it. She made, you know, it very clear that it was my choice. But I was given all of the information to make an informed decision. She, you know, arranged for pharmacy documents about the medication to be passed to me. She explained, you know, her past experience of using these drugs, and she even explained the dosages. And she, in fact, went as far as to put a really detailed plan on my notes about the potential usage of the drugs in question, so that if I was in hospital when she wasn't on shift, any other doctor that saw me would have access to this plan. So we didn't had the discussion, and then I was given them. We had the discussion, and she'd said, you know, think about it. And if you feel it's what you want, then you will have access to that. That is what you need. And it wasn't put on me, you know, in a sense of, oh, you're taking a risk, but if it's what, you know, you want to do, she absolutely recognized that, you know, at some point we would need to preserve mine and the baby's life because I was becoming so unwell.
Absolutely. And to ask you the next question, this isn't to scare anybody at all. It's actually to focus on how, as mums, when we have so much responsibility, when we're not even technically, you know, we don't have our baby in our arms, and the guilt that we feel throughout high premises. And I think maybe even if you don't have high premises, but one of the things that can happen when you take steroids is that it can essentially, you know, drug the baby. And this is something that you experienced where your daughter was basically, you weren't feeling any movements, were you? And one of the things they said to you was it could be because of the steroids now being in your system, they have, you know, made her sleepy, and that's why she's not moving. But you felt really guilty about that, didn't you?
Definitely for me, you know, I was still an inpatient at this time. I was being closely monitored. So, you know, within minutes of me explaining this, I, you know, had a baby monitor on, and they were checking that she was okay. And it was at this point, because I was actually on the IV steroids at quite a strong dosage, and they did explain, as you said, that it had quite likely got into her system as well. And there was a huge, huge, you know, feeling of sadness and guilt, because even if you know that what you're doing is the right thing for them, I'm sure you can relate that as, you know, a pregnant mum, you're getting closer to meeting your little one, that the last thing you want to think you've done is essentially drug them, you know, or them drugs going into their little body while you're protecting them, and it's because you've agreed to them drugs that they're potentially, you know, not able to have as active movements for some reason. And it was like a necessity at that point for me. Like, I had to make a change to ensure both of our well-being and safety. And just on a, you know, quite a short and temporary period, that resulted in her being still, and it was the most unnatural feeling for me. You get used to them wriggling around,
Yeah,
and
you do.
I almost felt myself, apologizing to her. I was so upset.
Yeah.
It was awful. But yeah, fortunately, I was well supported by the staff throughout
Yeah.
that experience, and reassured again by this consultant that was very understanding of hyperemesis and keen to help. And it was an isolated experience, as they give you a higher dose when you start, and that was when it happened. But
Yeah.
it just felt like I was doing something wrong before it even started. You're not even a mum yet, and
Yeah.
you're failing. It was echoing what I'd felt the whole time in my pregnancy. And I think a lot of the emotion that came out that day from me was just the fact that I'd constantly felt like a failure as a mum
Yeah.
before I even had the chance. And here I was with her asleep or something because of me. And I just, yeah, it wasn't a nice feeling, but who knows what would have happened if we hadn't have gone down that path.
What I will say, there's not many silver linings with hyperemesis, but I do think it prepares you exactly what you said, because when you then do get your baby, I mean, my son's 5 now, and I have to make decisions for him so many times, and I'm always torn of like what's the right thing to do, but then feeling guilty. And I do think it prepares you for that. Now, don't get me wrong, I would never want that experience or preparation. I'd much rather just have a non-HD pregnancy, thank you very much. But and it's a bit sad actually that you have those feelings so early on, because that sometimes comes later when they're here, and you do feel guilty about stuff like going back to work, or not being able to be with them all the time, or putting them in nursery. We get all these feelings. So I suppose it does prepare you for that. But when they're not here yet, that guilt is just quite overwhelming, isn't it? Because when they're here, you can rationalize it, but when they're not, you're still so desperate to just get them here. And I know that you, after that experience, you had two more scary experiences. One of them was when your breathing suddenly changed, and your husband was really worried about that, but they were kind of saying it's normal. And then a doctor actually in your presence started talking about leukemia. I mean, tell me about that. That must have been a massive shock to hear that word.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those scary words that, even when you're not feeling particularly well, that starts ringing every alarm bell in your mind. So it basically started with just some difficulty in catching my breath, which I was putting down to the fact that I was, at this point quite heavily pregnant, quite low on reserves. I was just assuming that I just was a bit, tired. But then I think I was just trying to walk up like a couple of steps, and I just couldn't do it. And it was like, wait a minute, this potentially isn't right. A few hours later that day, this sort of feeling continued. And once again, my husband's with me, another night, another hospital trip. And it was actually the fact that I was wearing almost like a, it's like, like a vest top where you can see the top of your chest and your shoulders. And my breathing was sort of so off that he could see that my chest was moving in sort of a funny way. And he said to me, "Your chest is looking a bit strange. Are you okay?" And I was like, "I don't actually think I'm okay." I was like, "I'm a bit scared." I was like, "I can't really breathe properly." And he was like, "I'll get someone. I'll get someone." And he rushes off, and someone comes, and I'm assured that, my heart's just racing a little because of the steroids, and that's completely normal. And as I'd said to you, Charlotte, you get so used to being told like this is normal, it's just the way things are, that I'm just like, oh, okay, I'm 7 months pregnant at this point, it's just normal, like carry on. And then the night continued, but I felt very unwell all night, unable to sort of take a proper breath and fill up my lungs. I was almost like trying to breathe more than I was able, and it was just an uncomfortable, unpleasant feeling. I didn't feel as though anything was going to happen in that moment, but I just kept wishing that this effect of the steroids would wear off and it would stop. And by the next day, some more investigations were undertaken, and I was quite quickly advised that I needed an immediate blood transfusion, which was equally terrifying because all I'd ever heard is that, blood transfusions whilst you're pregnant is not something that's, usually done because you don't want to pass that additional blood over to the baby. But, before you have time to sort of think on it too much, this blood bag's here and it's in progress. And I almost immediately felt better. And this was the point where, where I was asking, why has this happened and what's going on? And they were taking my blood samples to the lab and looking at them under microscopes, and I was told that the cells were abnormal, and that further testing was needed. The further testing came back, and I was advised that again abnormalities were showing on the more in-depth microscopes, and they explained that that could be for a number of reasons, blood disorders, and one of the words mentioned at this point was leukemia. And I was, like, what? What are you talking about? I was on my own. I didn't have anyone to advocate for me or to help me to understand. And, it was a bit like, oh, yeah, well, it could be that, but it could be a number of things. So we'll just see. And the next 3 days involved little sleeping through worry for me.
Wow.
And just waiting and waiting. And every day I was like, what is going on? What are the results of my blood tests? And they never really did get to the bottom of it, apart from the fact that my body was just doing all sorts of strange things. And, there was various levels of different bits and pieces in blood and urine and things that were up the wall. And fortunately, no blood disorders or anything otherwise was ever diagnosed.
Is that just one of those things that they have just put down to, we're not sure why that happened? They've just put it down to, it's just one of those strange things, but you're okay now. You don't have a blood disorder now, obviously you don't have leukemia, but, have they given you any kind of explanation, or has it always just been just one of those things, we're not sure why?
I had quite severe pregnancy-related anemia alongside the HG, and obviously my nutritional intake was, terribly, terribly poor, because when you've got HG, you just eat what you can whenever you can. So I think it was just sort of conclusion that, 7 months of not eating and drinking properly, having this anemia had just caused something in my body, to just go off.
After being told about the possibility of leukemia, and thankfully then being told that she didn't have leukemia, Roman also experienced another scare, but this time it was preeclampsia. Luckily, this was again just a scare, and she continued to be cared for by the consultant and had weekly meetings and checkups. She was weaned off the steroids and then sadly had to go back on them. She was exhausted and had suffered enough, and a decision was made to have an elective C-section at 37 weeks pregnant. Her daughter, Olia Daisy, was born on the 17th of September, 2019. So your daughter's here now. How old is she now?
She's 18 months now.
18 months old. How do we talk about this kind of next chapter in your life then? Because, a lot of the stories we hear, so as soon as the baby's out, any sickness that had been, going on during labour still disappears. Or for some women, it might be a couple of days. And we do try and talk about the aftermath of hyperemesis. But the reality is that a lot of women just kind of are so thankful that the whole thing is now over and that they don't have to worry about hyperemesis anymore. But sometimes we don't go into the details of what it's like, both physically and mentally. So for you, Rowan, I know you are quite active on Instagram talking about, the aftermath of hyperemesis as well as what you went through. And, women are reaching out to you, aren't they? Because you are someone who is talking about the aftermath. So in your own words, how would you describe, your postpartum period after hyperemesis, and where are you now physically?
So, like everyone else, I assumed upon delivery that, the pregnancy would end and so would the HG. But in summary, 18 months on, I'm still very much suffering with sort of symptoms that mirror the HG. Now, obviously, I'm not suffering with hyperemesis any longer. That is only attributed to pregnancy, but it has effectively triggered another condition within my body, which has continued the symptoms. And that's been going on for a year and a half since my daughter was born. So it just started off as feeling a little bit nauseous. To be honest, I convinced myself that I was imagining it, that I was so used to feeling sick that my brain just didn't know, how to not feel sick, and it would pass and just give it time. But all time brought was an increased sensation of nausea, which then led to vomiting as well. And over time, it's worsened and worsened to the point of being unable to eat and drink again, to losing significant amounts of weight again. I've not been able to return back to my job. So that day that we discussed with my line manager, I've never worked a full day since then, because I anticipated that I would return to my normal self, my fine physical health, but it just didn't happen. I think it's important to say that I've never suffered with anything like this prior to my pregnancy. I, you know, didn't have any health problems then, and it's just been a complete shock to me that I would experience anything other than what everyone else does, which is, almost total relief. And as you've mentioned a few times, I'm not sharing my experience to scare anyone, because people will reach out to me and say, I'm scared it won't end. But I think I'm almost one in a million. Like, it does end for pretty much everyone. But for some reason in me, this has triggered a condition, and my body is now suffering with the effects of something separate to hyperemesis, but it's essentially come from what my doctors explained as either the stress of hyperemesis or the stress and the physical strain. So it, can be sort of how it affected me, or how it affected me and the physical toll that my body went through with the muscles physically vomiting all of the time. It's like it's damaged that part of my body. And the diagnosis that, we think is most likely at this point, and that we're looking a lot into, is not something that can ever be cured. It's quite likely going to be lifelong, and if left, it would very likely lead to organ failure in the end, because you can't just not eat and drink and be sick every day of your life, because your body just cannot tolerate that, sort of level of actually, vomiting and not taking in what it needs. So I've spent the last, I'd say 12 months, because initially I was breastfeeding and I made the decision that I didn't want to medicate or, go through much at that point, because I wanted that time with my daughter, to experience that feeding journey after I'd not been able to obviously do feel like my body was doing things right while I was pregnant. So I sort of had that time, and then I've started trialing different medications. I've had numerous investigations, quite invasive investigations, like a number of unpleasant, things that I've had to go through to try and look at what's going on. And it's, day to day left me in a position where, it started as having a newborn baby, and now I've got a toddler. My husband's obviously still working to support us, and I've been left feeling very unwell caring for a baby. And it's been so difficult to have to get through that first time of being a mum and, adjusting. And it just wasn't what I envisaged again. Much like my pregnancy wasn't what I expected, the postpartum journey has been very, very difficult for me, and it, in a sense, the restrictions that we've lived through over the past 12 months have have hidden that from the majority of people in my life because they've not, you know, seen us at home. And a lot of communication is, you know, over the phone and messaging. So people don't see it. And I think they may even be shocked to learn of how much I've really suffered and struggled and how, you know, I've had appointments most weeks and almost rattled with the amount of medication that I've relied on to simply survive and get through the day. You know, the black and white of it now is that I take medication to enable me to eat and drink so I don't die. Like that is where I'm at. You know, I have to rely on help to eat and drink, and I'm, you know, under the care of a dietitian as well to help me with supplements to ensure that I am, you know, remaining healthy and well supported and hopefully avoiding any other issues, you know, as I discussed, that come from general malnutrition. And I definitely have felt like a stronger advocate for myself this side of things. You know, I know the importance of looking after your health, and I'm not afraid to keep pushing and keep asking. And, you know, I want to be the best mum that I can be to my little girl. I feel like so much of this first 18 months has been taken from us. Like, our time was done, and, you know, a lot of days are, you know, on the couch or trying to do things, or much my husband and I taking it in turns to care for her whilst I maybe don't feel so well and have a rest and he takes over. So it's sort of, I suppose, like living through hyperemesis whilst you have a baby, which a lot of, you know, second, third time mums will be aware of how hard it is to do that. You know, I haven't obviously had that exact experience, but I can relate to how difficult it would be. So the current situation is just that I'm still having regular consultations. I am under the care of two consultants, one of which is a specialist in this field. I also have regular appointments with my GP and the dietitian, and I have a psychologist that I speak to as well. So I've essentially got five professionals now working with me to look after my general well-being.
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting because, I mean, I have one or two women have reached out to me and said that they now have something called cyclical vomiting syndrome. And again, and they're like, I don't know if you know much about this, and the research into that, I mean, it's very similar to hyperemesis. There isn't very much out there and not many people that you can go and talk to. And I think you're absolutely right in what you say, is that whether this, and it's very difficult, isn't it? Because the women that I've, these two women that I'm speaking to, they're very much like, you know, they can't say definitely this has come from the hyperemesis, but they also can't say that it hasn't. And their kind of treatment processes that they're going through is very much an investigatory kind of approach. Like, we have to try different things because this isn't a very simple condition to look after, because there isn't just like one magic pill or one magic treatment that's going to change it. And it seems like the science around it and the research around it is ever evolving, that there isn't one concrete answer. And I know you said to me, you know, in your situation, you're very similar in that it's not on your first trip to the GP, someone went, oh yeah, it's this, you know, it's very much, we have to investigate and look into. But one thing I will take away, and I know you said you don't blame anyone, but what I do find interesting is that you're now under the care of five different professionals with a condition that is, that has a similarity to hyperemesis. You're obviously being taken very seriously, but when you were pregnant, being under the care of one professional was impossible for you. And just seeing the two different journeys that you've had and being taken seriously, I think is just such an incredible image for people listening to this as to how different that was.
It's definitely been different. I almost feel as though it's your, almost in a predisposition when you're pregnant that you're going to complain. It's like with a pregnancy test comes someone that will complain.
Yeah.
They will say that they are sick regardless of their circumstances. And I think the distinguishing factor in the postpartum journey is that it wasn't expected for me to, you know, have this voice and say that I've not been well. And, you know, it's almost like it can't be blamed on hormones anymore. It can't be blamed on being normal. So I have to have notice taken. And I do feel I've been taken seriously from day one with this condition. Mm-hmm. You know, the consultant that looks after me now, the one I see most often, has been very supportive, and I couldn't fault, you know, the way that he's handled my circumstances. And even the specialist doctor that I referred to, you know, had a great amount of respect for what I experienced during the pregnancy. And I just felt as though there's been a different approach, and it's definitely been the way this side of things is being handled is how I wish the first side of things would be handled, because it's great after me now, but it's not too late, you know, to reverse it. Like, it can't be reversed now. We have to just work on managing symptoms, which is there's a whole list of, which is why there's so many people involved. You know, we've got to get different people to work on different things, but it just makes me wonder, you know, for example, I'm now being prescribed supplements of nutrient drinks. Like, why was that never considered when I was pregnant and my vomiting was so
well,
much worse
than
what it is now?
That's one of the examples I was going to say. You now are under the care of a nutritionist, and that I think every high premises woman should be offered that. Now, I know it's all different for all of us. Some people are able to keep some food down. You know, some people can have water, but regardless of the situation, and that was one of those examples I was thinking in my head as to why weren't you given that option at 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, in and onward weeks pregnant? Whereas now it is, I mean, that resource is there, right? Whoever your nutritionist is, she's been there for a long time. I'm sure that's what her job is. Those resources in your community, in your area, are available. But when you were pregnant, it was just not something that anyone offered you. And I find that, and I think your story is such a great example, Rowan, because this now, this aftercare, I think if you're getting that aftercare now, that aftercare exists, it's out there, that resource is there. And I think everyone in the community, all we're asking for is what you're kind of, you know, receiving now, being available when you're pregnant. And you know, we're not asking for new roles to be created or new people to suddenly have to take on new jobs. All those people exist. We just don't get access to them.
Yeah, I think that, you know, pregnant women need to be treated with sort of the same level. I think the right word could be the same level of seriousness and concern that I've been treated with after. I mean, obviously, I'm really grateful that the experience now is easier than it was, because obviously I'd already done 9 months of what I would describe as fighting, and you know, I didn't want to have to do that again. And this journey presents enough challenges on its own without having to, you know, almost argue with people that I am deserving of medical treatment. But this time around, you know, the eating has been a real difficulty for me. So I have a lot of trouble with my diet, with eating and keeping things down. And you know, I've had the opportunity to discuss feeding tubes, for example, with people, you know, temporary and permanent ones. Like, we've had those conversations. I know at what point, if my condition deteriorates, that is going to be an option for me. And, you know, I'm seeing women on social media that live in different countries to us, you know, America or New Zealand, and they are being offered temporary feeding tubes on occasions, and I've even seen permanent ones whilst pregnant, because the nutritionists are keeping an eye on them daily, advising that is essential to prevent malnutrition, you know. And I was obviously literally starving and dehydrated majority of days in my pregnancy, but I was never considered for supplement drinks or any sort of feeding tube or anything along that line. And it wasn't a case of I was assessed and it was deemed not appropriate for me. I was never given that assessment. So, you know, if I ever was in a position to have another pregnancy, then these are definitely questions that I would be asking. You know, like you said, I'd be saying, it is available, you know, can I have a conversation to discuss whether it's suitable for me? And I obviously, you know, I feel the emotion around that, because I wonder has my experience with the first time being pregnant become a barrier to me having more children? Because what kind of care will I receive? You know, if I had the appropriate level of care, it would probably be possible. But if I didn't have that level of care, then, you know, it wouldn't. So really, it would dictate my family life, if you can understand me, you know.
I absolutely can, yeah. And I think every woman feels that. And I think a lot of us, with that, because if we don't have your health concerns that you have, we just take a massive leap of faith, a massive jump off a cliff, and just hope that someone catches us. And as much as you can put things in place, right, and you can find the good GP and find the good midwife and find that consultant that did help you that one time and get under their care, I still think it is a massive leap of faith, because it just takes that one consultant to not be on shift that night, and perhaps they haven't written in your notes, this is what you have to do with her, and it can quite easily spiral out of control again. So in your situation, you know, you would have to have almost, you know, I'm talking like signed contracts here, Rowan, like people are literally signing up saying, yeah, I'm going to help you, because otherwise you wouldn't want to take that risk, would you, with your health, because of the daughter that you do have.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, this time around, it's not just a case of I'd be poorly and it would be inconvenient, you know, it's essentially be putting my health and ultimately my life on the line, which is just not a risk that you're willing to take when you've got a child, you know. You know, the minute that you become a mum, your life changes and your priorities change. So, you know, when people make them passing comments, I'm sure you've heard them as well. Oh, when's number two? You know, you're having another one. It's just so much more complicated than that. And, you know, even now I've come across doctors that are of the opinion, oh, you won't have hyperemesis again, so we don't need to worry about that.
Oh, my God. No, and stop it. Stop talking. I can't handle that. I hate when people do that. And friends do that. They're like, well, maybe you won't get it. Yeah, maybe I won't. But if I do, I have to plan for the fact that I will do. I can't just sit here and cross my fingers.
I know. It's like they think, oh, you know, let's just hope that you don't.
And let's hope it away. Yeah. I mean, if I could hope for things and they would come true, I'd be living in a mansion now and I have homes around the world. Like, hoping is very, having faith, I appreciate, is helpful in your everyday life, but you can't hope that something's not going to happen and then make it not happen. You know, you have to have things in place, you have to have people supporting you, otherwise you're just setting yourself up for a fall.
I mean, the one thing, you know, that I'd say to others and that I do know now is that if you can contact, you know, an organisation or someone that knows a little bit more about, you know, treatments and options available, then having someone that can advocate with you by your side, you know, to look at having another pregnancy would make the world of difference. You know, I didn't have anyone in a professional sense. It was almost, you know, me and my, you know, strong family, we were fighting this on our own. And, you know, you are equipped with experience, and you know, I always think to myself, if I knew this then, you know, how I would have done it differently, which is, you know, the wonder of hindsight, isn't it?
And that hindsight, you know, I always say you can't prepare for a hyperemesis pregnancy if it's your first. You just can't. And even if you have a family member, perhaps your mother or your sister or an aunt who's had it, so you might have an inkling that you might get it, you still can never prepare 100%, because you can't possibly imagine what could or couldn't happen to you. With the second one, you do have that hindsight, and you are able to put things in place. But still, I really do feel like to take that leap, you really need doctors almost to sign in blood, right? That they're going to help you, because if you've been dismissed in the past, that feeling of that could happen again is quite overwhelming. And I do think that limits a lot of family sizes, because women just aren't able to take that risk, because
and rightly so. Why should you know, take a risk with your life and
exactly,
you know, your family's life? But obviously there's also being naive your first time around. I'm sure if you didn't know what was coming, you know, you'd have been terrified. I mean, for me it was a blessing telling myself at, you know, 9-10 weeks, like, oh, it's going to end soon, it won't continue. And it was only really after the 20-week mark where I was kind of like,
oh yeah, no, I'm gonna have this the whole time.
Yeah,
but I'm so glad that I didn't know that then, you know. Yeah. I don't know how I'd have got through it if I'd have known how scary HG really was, to be yeah. honest.
Yeah,
equally saying that, you know, also that there is so much, you know, emotional support out there for you. You know, there may be them struggles that women are facing with their healthcare professionals, but even, you know, if women are reaching out on social media and they're listening to this and they're finding themselves, you know, with this content, it's so valuable to just know that other people have gone through this and they've survived it.
Exactly. I think that's a wonderful note to end it on. So Rowan, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story with us. And I know that everyone listening will be wishing you all the best for the future with your own health and the struggles that you're and the journey you're currently on. And I really do hope that all of these fantastic people who are now your care team will work this out and will get you to a place where, as you've said, there's possibly not a cure for this, but to a point where it's manageable so you can have that quality of life that you so deserve. So thank you.
Thanks, Charlotte.
I have thoroughly enjoyed speaking to each and every one of you about your High Premises journeys. And while sadly, this is going to be the last series of the High Premises Files podcast, I am going to be coming back with other things I'm doing, more film-based work, which again will raise awareness of this debilitating and life-changing disease. If you are listening to this and currently struggling, please know that you aren't alone. Please do reach out to your national or perhaps regional high premises support group. Please reach out to the charities as well, because they really have the most up-to-date information about this condition and they can help you. If you do need someone to talk to, then my messages are always open, but I would definitely urge you to talk to your family if you can. Get support from anyone who will give it. Once again, thank you so much for listening. And if you're currently pregnant, you can do this. You can get through this. And I'm so sorry that you're having to, but hopefully one day we will have a cure for high premises, so no other woman has to go through this again. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Hyperemesis Files. If you have been affected by anything that has been spoken about in today's podcast, please visit your local Hyperemesis charity or speak to a healthcare provider. For more information about the documentary Sick, The Battle Against HG, please visit www.thesickfilm.co.uk.